The peddlers and the meddlers, they buy and they sell. They destroyed your city, they'll destroy you as well. The lecherous and treacherous, a hairman full of weather, each of them bigger than all men put together. Sluggers and muggers, wearing fancy gold.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Richard Wolff, who's a professor emeritus of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and currently a visiting professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School University in New York City. He's the author of Occupy the Economy, Challenging Capitalism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Wolff.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And what do you make of the fiscal follies in Washington, D.C., in this yet another self-inflicted wound from the Tea Party caucus, who profess to be concerned about the deficit, but every time they have their political tantrums, they actually add to our debt because our credit gets downgraded. And just yesterday, Fitch said that they would downgrade the U.S. credit if this impasse continues.
Well, in my view, it is, as you suggest, mostly theatrics, mostly a psychodrama carefully choreographed in Washington to distract us from what the real issue is. And the real issue, which might surprise some listeners, is that the Republicans and the Democrats agree on the basic question. That is, they're going to impose austerity on the American economy. That's what it's called in Europe when you raise taxes in the middle of an economic downturn. That hurts the economy because if the taxes are taken from people and businesses, then they will spend less money. And at the same time, the government cuts spending, which of course immediately negatively impacts the economy because all the individuals laid off by the government, all the companies losing orders from the government, they will in turn cut back on their activities. And so the remarkable thing is that Republicans and Democrats are both in favor of raising taxes, more or less, and cutting government spending. All they disagree about are the details. The Republicans would like to do less with taxes, and the Democrats would like to do more with taxing folks at the upper end and stuff like that. But the basic and the most horrible part of all of this is that both Republicans and Democrats have been won over to the idea that the way you respond to an economic crisis now entering its sixth year, the way you respond to a government bailout program that really only helped corporations, big banks, and so on, left everybody else out, was by making the people pay in the form of higher taxes and lower government services for a crisis they didn't cause and for a bailout they didn't get the benefits of. It's a way of shifting the burden of a system that doesn't work real well onto the mass of people. And the way you do that without confronting mass anger is you have exaggerated jousting games between Republicans and Democrats over the details so that nobody notices the common program. And if I could say a final word about it, we already know what it means to impose austerity in the middle of a crisis. Great Britain has been doing that for several years and has now entered the second recession since the crisis hit in 2007. Greece is a country that has been doing that, and look at the disaster there. Likewise, Spain, Italy. We should be running in the opposite direction in our society, but we don't. We want the mass of people to pay in the form of tax increases and spending cuts by the government, and that's what these two parties are doing. And it is something that the American people should be refusing to participate in, rather than getting all excited about a jousting battle over what are merely details.
Now, Richard, the heart of what you're saying is that both parties have agreed on deficit reduction, specifically on what's left of the government spending in the discretionary arena. And this will mean that we will end up with an American government that is a war machine and a pension plan. The Pentagon, the war machine, the pension plan, what's left of Social Security. And I don't understand why the American people don't recognize how much their very government, which is a measure of civilization, what government services provide, is already on the chopping block.
Yes, I think that we are seeing in these years, the years since 2007 and 8, a whole series of chickens coming home to roost, if I might use that metaphor. Let me give you an example. For 50 years, we have been unwilling in the United States to debate the economic system that we live with, capitalism. We debate our school systems, our transportation system, our energy systems, but we do not debate capitalism. It is taboo, it's a legacy of the Cold War, and you know, if you do not debate a system that you rely upon, then it goes bad. Then it does not recognize its flaws, and they don't get repaired. And so one of the things happening to us now is a belated discovery that this system is unable to deliver the goods. For the mass of people, capitalism is now delivering ever more precarious jobs, if they get a job at all, delivering very precarious income from a job, if you have a job at all, requiring a whole new generation to pay for education with unbearable and unsustainable debts. We never did that to our people before. And now we're talking seriously about cutting Social Security, cutting Medicare, delivering even poorer services to the poor through the Medicaid system. This is a political economy, a system that is not working for the majority of people. And as jobs in the country, as American corporations shift cheaper workers abroad, they are, in a sense, abandoning the United States. The future of our country is going to look a lot like those places where American corporations earlier abandoned the community. And I'm thinking of places like Detroit or Cleveland or Camden, New Jersey, or thousands of other places. We have to recognize that if we permit this economic system to continue to do what it calls business as usual, we're looking at a long period of economic decline for ourselves and our children that ought to make all Americans, not just party folks, sit up and realize something big has to change, or else the outcome is not anything that anybody would want.
Well, Richard Wolff, specifically, though, in terms of what we've been talking about earlier about the latest follies in Washington, D.C., and the extent to which the debate is over how much of what's left in the discretionary budget that's going to be cut, and nobody's going to, either Democrat or Republican, are going to seriously go after the pork in the defense budget, and somehow or other they'll find ways to go after Social Security, even though the Democrats say they're not. The point that I'd like to add to this is that criticism or a critique of capitalism aside, what's happening in America is that the capitalists, or at least a number of them, like the Koch brothers and others, have declared war on government. And because our government is up for sale, and because of Citizens United, he who has the most money can buy the most politicians, we have a situation where American capitalists are destroying what's left of our government. So to my mind, that's the first battle to fight, surely, is to stop the destruction of government by the greedy few.
I couldn't agree more. My only point of stress is that we have to recognize that the way this system is organized, where the profits flow, what is the condition of most wage earners, the discretionary money available to to influence politics is overwhelmingly on one side, on the side of large corporations who keep controlling the masses of profits that, ironically, their workers produce for them. And you have to remember that those businesses are not stupid. They understand that the long trajectory of capitalism has always carried with it the shadow of universal suffrage, of democracy, that the mass of people can, if they got together, use their control over the government, even if it's only by voting, to undo politically the discrimination and the inequality that they suffer economically. And for the capitalists to prevent that from happening, they figured out they have to control politics so that it isn't used to offset what they do in the economy. And that's what you're seeing now. In a sense, the startling ability of that same group of businesses to not apologize for imposing a crisis, to not apologize for taking the bailout for themselves, even though they caused the crisis, but have the nerve through these fiscal follies in Washington, now to be followed by the debt ceiling theater, to actually work successfully to get the mass of people to suffer the tax increases and the social spending cutbacks needed to pay for a good bit of the disaster of this crisis and of those bailouts. As long as we don't change that basic system, whatever we may say about the assault on the government, and you're quite right, we won't get beyond bemoaning it and criticizing it because we have left the resources available to shape government so lopsidedly on one side of the ledger.
Again, I'm speaking with Richard Wolff, Professor Emeritus of Economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and currently a visiting professor in the Graduate Program for International Affairs at the New School University in New York City. He's the author of Occupy the Economy, Challenging Capitalism. Now, Richard Wolff, if the battle, in a simplistic sense, is between the power of money versus the numbers of voters, and even though there are only a handful of capitalists, they have cleverly, through the media and through their influence over our campaign systems, which are, of course, money-driven, they are able to level the playing field and get enough people to buy enough representatives in the Congress to be able to get their way. So the only alternative that I can see would be for the numbers to show up. And in the last election, there were some hopeful signs of the young and minority voters and women showing up. I mean, if people aren't aware of what you're talking about, the systemic reasons for why we are being downsized here in America, short of some miracle in media that will suddenly appear overnight and educate people, what do you think can be done in order to get to level the playing field between the power of money and the numbers of people? Only 60% showed up in the last election. Less people voted in this last critical election than voted in 2004 in Kerry versus Bush.
Well, I think the answer to that question, and it certainly is one of the biggest and most important questions, comes from American history. And that's where we always should look, at least in part, for answers to those kinds of important questions. Let's go back to the 1930s. At that time, capitalists were, again, very, very strong. Had the preponderance of resources, were busy buying and influencing politics, much as they are today. But we had a terrible depression, and in that depression, something happened that is not happening, at least not yet, with the exception of the Occupy Wall Street movement, which is why it's so important. Here's what happened in the 30s. We had a determined commitment by the labor movement to organize American workers by going to them and saying, this depression threatens you, and the capitalists are going to use it to make your life even more miserable than the unemployment and the poverty you're already suffering. Your only protection is to unionize. And we saw millions of Americans who had never been in a union before join. The greatest upsurge of union organizing in the history of the United States. We never had anything like it before, and we've never had it again since. At the same time, we had an upsurge in socialist and communist parties in the United States, working closely with the entity that organized all those workers, called the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organizations. And they basically organized millions of Americans to demand either that the government provide them with real massive services, or there would be no capitalism. They would move for a social change, and those capitalists would no longer be in the position to get the profits and to use them as they had. And they went to Roosevelt, the president at that time, also a Democrat, and they said that to him. And Roosevelt was a smart politician, and he heard. And Roosevelt said, okay, I'm going to go to the rich and the corporations, and I'm going to explain what has to happen. And he went to them. He was out of that community anyway. He went and he said to the rich and the corporations, I have to take care of the mass of people. This system is not working for them, and this system is in danger if we don't do something. So I want to do a massive program of helping average Americans. And you, gentlemen, he said, looking across the table, you are going to pay for it. And half of them hated him for saying it, and the other half were so afraid of what might happen with this upsurge of mass organization that they agreed. So Roosevelt went ahead. And what Americans perhaps don't remember is what happened in the depths of the Great Depression. Roosevelt created the Social Security system for the first time in American history. Everybody over 65 was going to get a check every month for the rest of their lives. Wouldn't have to be a burden on their kids, wouldn't have to be a burden on their community, would be recognized for the life of work they had given by being given a decent government retirement pension. He also created the unemployment compensation system. We never had that before. The federal government giving a weekly check for a year or two to workers thrown out of work through no fault of their own. And perhaps most dramatic, his third act. Between 1934 and 41, Roosevelt created and filled 12.5 million jobs. He put people to work. He basically said to the American people, if the private sector can't or won't do it, I'll do it. And he did it. Now, we have to understand that he didn't do that because he's a nice guy. He did that because masses of people were organized into unions and political parties that carried a threat. You better do something. You better stop all this talk about austerity. You better stop this business of taxing masses of people at a time of depression or cutting desperately needed social services at a time of depression. That's gone. You're going to have to tax corporations and the rich. And you're going to have to use the money to take care of the mass of the people, or else you're going to destroy your own economic system and the privilege it gives you. That's what happened then. And the irony of America to this day is that after World War II, when taxes on corporations and rich people were much, much higher than they are today, precisely to pay for those social programs, the business interests that hated all of that, that were bitter that they had to make those concessions, they went to work from 1945 right to this minute. Long before there were Koch brothers, there were other people doing the same thing. And their goal was what we now know to be our history. They destroyed and eliminated the Communist Party as a political force. They destroyed and eliminated the Socialist parties as political forces. And then they destroyed the labor movement. Just to give you one number today, the percentage of private employees in America who are members of or represented by a union is less than 7%. All right? What they have done is destroyed those institutions and organizations who were precisely capable of doing what you said, Ian, namely outweighing the money with the mass of the people. They destroyed those organizations because they understood what I just mentioned, what that history means. Therefore, the conclusion is clear. We have to develop now new organizations, or we have to revive those old ones. But we have to do one way or the another, mobilize the mass of people to push for a completely different outcome. We know it can be done because the American history already shows us that. And maybe this time we can go a little further than they did in the 1930s. Not merely get masses of people to be helped with the Depression, but also finally to make the changes in the economic system so that we're not constantly repeating this history as we have so far in the long story of the United States.
Well, just in closing, Richard Wolff, I think it's pretty hard to sell communism today, and I think you can make a case that the communists in Soviet Russia and in China have done more to hurt socialism than American capitalists did in their efforts to undermine American communists and socialists. It seems to me that you're never going to be able to sell communism anywhere today.
Absolutely. You're going to have to learn the lessons of what mistakes those folks made, what decisions they made that were counterproductive. You have to be sure not to reproduce those. Certainly, you learn from all the different histories. But let's remember that whatever you call it, whether you call it socialism or communism, or you call it horizontal organization, or any other language that you find effective in communicating with people, the bottom line is always the same. We have a system driven by profits, driven by the accumulation of capital in the hands of ever smaller numbers of gigantic corporations who have the resources and the incentive to control the politics and the culture. Unless we deal with that question, unless we raise fundamentally the simple argument, calling it whatever name people will understand and listen to. But the basic argument has always been, who controls the product of the labor of the community? Do you have it democratically controlled so that the mass of people, who are, after all, the producers, make the decisions about what is done with the fruits of their labor? Or, and you can call that community economics, you can call it democratic economy, hundreds of terms. Or do you permit capitalism, a system organized to take the product of the mass of people and concentrate it in a tiny number of hands, the boards of directors, the major shareholders who make all of the basic decisions that the rest of us have to live with? If you don't deal with that problem, no matter what you call it, then you will not be able to go to the root of what is ailing the United States. And let me add a word of urgency. In a peculiar way, the Tea Party, those folks all concerned about losing their guns these days, they have a sense of something fundamental slipping away from them. Sure, they focus on an issue that isn't the burning one. It isn't what's the problem. But unless the folks like us come up with an analysis of what the problem is, we are not going to be able to tap into what more and more Americans are coming to understand, which is that this system, both at its economic pinnacles and at its political pinnacles, is not for them, not by them, not of them, and is plunging them into a very bad situation, and even worse for their kids.
Well, Richard Wolff, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much, Ian. I appreciate your invitation.
Again, I've been speaking with Richard Wolff, who's a professor emeritus of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and is currently a visiting professor in the Graduate Program for International Affairs at the New School University in New York City. He's the author of Occupy the Economy, Challenging Capitalism. And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting, ianmasters.com. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.